Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Julian Assange made his first public address since leaving prison to a hearing of the Human Rights Committee of the Council of Europe in France. He explains that he pled guilty to the basic methods of journalism. Excerpts from his address and some analysis. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has made his first public address since he was released from prison. Assange was attending a hearing at the Human Rights Committee of the Council of Europe in France. Assange said he was still exhausted and recovering from years in jail. He spent most of the last 14 years either in the Ecuadorian embassy in London to avoid arrest or locked up at the UK's Belmarsh prison, where he fought extradition to the US. In 2010, legal action against Assange started after hundreds of thousands of leaked documents about the Afghanistan and Iraq wars were published. Assange was released under a plea bargain in June. Let's take a listen to what he said a little earlier.
I am not free today because the system worked. I am free today after years of incarceration because I pled guilty to journalism. I pled guilty to seeking information from a source. I pled guilty to obtaining information from a source. And I pled guilty to informing the public what that information was. I did not plead guilty to anything else. I hope my testimony today can serve to highlight the weaknesses of the existing safeguards, and to help those whose cases are less visible but who are equally vulnerable.
And we can get more from DW correspondent Jack Parrock, who's following this story for us in Strasbourg. Jack, why did Assange chose to speak at the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, and why now?
What's interesting is that he chose this committee, which is ostensibly to uphold the rights of journalists, to uphold the rights of freedom of speech. And the UK is also a member of that. Obviously, most of his ordeal was in the United Kingdom. So that's why he chose it. But there's also a case going on at the moment in this human rights body, which is specifically about his case and his designation as a political prisoner, which is ongoing. And it's ongoing this week. So that's kind of why now and why here. He could have potentially chosen a media outlet to do an interview, but instead he wanted to speak to all of the media and all of the parliamentarians from the 46 European countries that are signed up to this human rights body.
And Jack, I mean, he says that he's still exhausted, he's still recovering from his years spent in jail. Can you give us your impressions of how he looked, you know, the way he was speaking? What sense did he convey?
Yeah, there was a lot of questions about what type of Julian Assange we would have here. He's obviously pre his arrest and all he went through, he was a very bombastic, outspoken character. Today, he was in a relatively plain blue suit. His hair was sort of neatly combed over. He spoke quite softly and mildly, but quite forcefully as well, made some very clear points. His wife, Stella, was sort of fussing over the button to turn the microphone phone on and off when he was speaking and answering questions. And I think you could see from the team around him that they are very concerned still about his well-being. Indeed, this public speech, this visit to Strasbourg, is actually being called a sort of pause in his recovery, in his rehabilitation back into society. And he expressed and did show some emotion when he was talking about the situation that he went through, both in the Ecuadorian embassy and in Belmarsh prison, which you can tell has affected him quite deeply.
And what about the audience's reaction, Jack?
As I say, he's a relatively divisive figure. Actually, here he received a standing ovation from the parliamentarians at the end of his speech. A lot of them have been very, very keen for him to have been released and campaigned for his release. But there are a lot of people that are slightly concerned with some of the practices that he pursued when he was the founder of WikiLeaks and the way in which he did it. So he does, although he's been released and there's a lot of sympathy for the situation that he went through, he is still a relatively controversial figure. And the big question is, what will he do now? Will he try and work as a human rights defender, or will he perhaps pull himself back out of the public eye?
DW correspondent Jack Parrott in Strasbourg.
That report from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, France 24. An interview with Tim Dawson, General Secretary of the International Federation of Journalists. 10% of the journalists in Gaza have been killed, a shocking record in the war. He discusses the reliability of coverage in a war if those on the ground covering it are being killed. Then a review of the Israeli press from Thursday. France 24.
The fighting in Gaza and Lebanon has been the deadliest conflict on record for journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists says that since October 7th, at least 116 journalists have been killed, 35 injured, 54 arrested, and 2 reported missing. The CPJ goes further, determining that at least 5 journalists were directly targeted by Israeli forces in killings, which the CPJ classifies as murders. Another 10 cases, it's still investigating. Israel denies it targets journalists and says emphatically that it would never do so. But since the war began, 4 Al Jazeera journalists have been killed. In May, the channel was banned from operating inside Israel. This past week, its bureau in Ramallah was stormed by masked troops and it ordered to close it for an initial period of 45 days. So what to make of the war as it widens and worsens, and what's to come of the people on the ground who are trying to cover it? Joining us from London is Tim Dawson. He's a Deputy General Secretary of the International Federation of Journalists. Tim, hello to you.
The important thing is just the scale, the proportion of journalists who died. It's at least 10% of the journalists who were working in Gaza who lost their lives, which is a much higher mortality rate than any other occupation in Gaza, where, you know, the general population has obviously sustained terrible, terrible losses.
Yeah, and we heard Israel say several times before that the journalists they were targeting might have been terrorists. Critics say that's a smear campaign. Where do you come on that? Come down on that?
So far as I'm concerned, all of those that I know of were working as journalists. Clearly, some of them were working, you know, for news platforms that have political affiliations, as you would expect in any kind of plural society. But the suggestion that so many people, many of them, you know, well known to broadcast audiences and to as photographers, that they are all terrorist operatives, it is exactly as you say. It's a smear. It's a terrible, terrible, tragic and unfair smear.
Yeah, many press advocates accusing Israel of acting with impunity. These crimes are well documented. Given that, why isn't there more pressure on Israel?
Well, international organizations such as my own, the International Federation of Journalists, are doing our very utmost to put as much pressure as we can. I mean, we, like the CPJ that you mentioned earlier, have complaints with the International Criminal Court in The Hague. I mean, in fact, we have complaints that predate the current crisis, among them, for example, about Shireen Abu Akleh, the Al Jazeera anchor who was killed in the Jenin camp 2 years ago now. Now, the UN produced as close, I think, to a judicial and independent report as is possible, and it said she was unquestionably killed either recklessly or deliberately by the Israeli Defense Forces. We believe that the International Criminal Court should investigate that and have been pressuring them to do so. I think the feeling that international justice has left this conflict behind is deeply corrosive. I spent some time looking up sort of comparative mortality rates. If you look, for example, at the Vietnam War, the American Marine Corps, so the troops involved in the most sort of aggressive hand-to-hand fighting, they lost 5% of the men they deployed. 10% of guards and journalists have died. It is off the scale of description.
Israel suggesting that a ground invasion could be looming. What would the impact be?
I think the impact will be terrible. I mean, we're talking about, quite densely populated areas. Already, if you look at pictures that have come from local media of strikes on dense urban areas, huge bombs falling on neighborhoods. Now, I appreciate that Israel says that they're targeting Hezbollah leaders and operative units, but if you massive bombs on dense urban areas, the collateral damage might be 10 or 20 times the number of people that compared to what you're actually targeting. And I think that's a highly unacceptable level of kind of civilian casualty rate to knock out relatively small numbers of military operatives. The International Federation of Journalists has maintained for 30 years a killed list of journalists who lose their lives during the course of work, who are murdered fundamentally. It's usually one here, one there, regimes targeting people who've written or filmed disobliging things. When the scale of death is so great as it has been in Gaza, it makes regimes killing two or three people, seem like relatively small beer. So a tragedy on this scale really creates an atmosphere which is corrosive all over the world, I believe.
All right, Tim. I want to thank you very much for speaking to us this week. Tim Dawson from the International Federation of Journalists.
I'll start with Haaretz, Oliver, which has been often critical of the Israeli regime and Benjamin Netanyahu himself. They say that Israel is in the midst of the most difficult period in its history under a reckless leadership headed by a man whose only promise he has made and kept to his people is to live by the sword. They say under his thoughtless leadership, Israel is taking giant steps towards a regional war. That's the sort of thing you'd expect from Haaretz, but maybe not from the other papers who have been closer to Netanyahu and the government. I'll start with Israel Hayom, because even they have a kind of air of caution this morning. And this is a paper who in the past has been heavily criticised for being too favourable towards Netanyahu. They asked the question, how far does Israel want to take this war with Iran? This piece says that they need to account for the possibility of a broader regional conflict because Iran could retaliate not against just Israel, but also against its allies from the US to Saudi Arabia and Jordan. So according to this, Israel would need to coordinate any attack with Washington. They also need to consider the impact of escalating the conflict in Lebanon and Gaza, which could flare up even more. Ynet, which is one of the country's most read news websites, say that they strike a similar tone, saying especially because any attack against Iran could push Iran to accelerate its nuclear ambitions and trigger a full-scale conflict. While speaking of Iran, the message is rather different in their dailies this morning. It's a more bullish tone. This is the Tehran Times. Iran's hand on the trigger, it reads. It's a paper very close to the government, and they point out that the attack of hundreds of ballistic missiles was in line with the UN Charter. Iran says it used only a portion of its capabilities in that strike on Tuesday, with multiple high-ranking Iranian officials. They've stated that they're ready to take more severe action if the regime continues its aggression and responds to those Iranian missile strikes.
That interview and press review were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites. on to NHK World Radio Japan. Israel bombed many targets in Yemen in retaliation for an intercepted ballistic missile fired in support of Gaza and Lebanon. Hassan Nasrallah, a leader of Hezbollah in Lebanon, was assassinated by a bomb from Israel, intensifying the war. United Nations personnel have been present near the Israeli-Lebanon border site since 1978, with 10,000 present last month. World leaders are urging Israel and Iran to back away from further escalation. NHK Japan.
Israel says it has carried out airstrikes against targets linked to the Houthi group in Yemen. The Israeli military made the announcement on Sunday. It said power plants and a seaport used by the group were among the targeted sites. The Houthis are backed by Iran. They fired a ballistic missile toward an airport in the Israeli commercial hub of Tel Aviv on Saturday. The group said it conducted the launch in support of Gaza and Lebanon. But the Israeli military noted the missile was intercepted outside its country's territory. Meanwhile, Israel has reported it carried out an airstrike on a suburban area in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. It said it also conducted aerial attacks against roughly 45 Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon. The Israeli military claims more than 20 other people died in the strike that killed Hezbollah's leader on Friday. Hassan Nasrallah was the target of an attack on the group's Beirut headquarters. The Israeli military maintains the other individuals were terrorists. Reuters news agency has quoted sources as saying Nasrallah's body was recovered from the site of the assaults.
UN personnel have had a presence near the Israel-Lebanon border since 1978. As of last month, more than 10,000 troops were stationed there, including many from Indonesia, Italy, and India. The UN spokesperson says right now they can't carry out their mandate.
They're not able to do patrols in most of their responsibility, given the intensity of the fire going on both sides of the blue line.
Also, Japan's chief cabinet secretary expressed concern over Israeli actions.
Japan calls for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah to prevent the situation from worsening further.
Hayashi urged Israel to take precautions against civilian casualties. He says there are about 50 Japanese nationals in the area, and Japan is working to secure their safety.
World leaders are urging Israel and Iran to back away from escalations that could be hurtling the Middle East toward a wide-scale conflict. They're still anticipating Israel's response to Iran's massive missile strike earlier this week. The UN Security Council held an emergency session to discuss the situation and how to dial down tensions. Permanent member France condemned Iran's missile attack, but told Israel it also opposes the ongoing ground operation in Lebanon. Israel's UN ambassador said its attackers will face serious consequences.
This is not just a threat to Israel, this is a threat to the entire world. We will defend our people, and our response will be swift and decisive.
Iran says the strike was in response to Israel's killing of Hamas and Hezbollah leaders and issued a similar warning.
We strongly warn against any further act of aggression by Israeli terrorist regime against our national security and vital interests. Iran is fully prepared to take further defensive measures if necessary.
Lebanon is calling for international support, with fighting between Israel and Hezbollah creating a humanitarian crisis. Now, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has been barred from entering Israel. The country's foreign minister says it's because Guterres failed to unequivocally condemn the Iranian attack. The UN spokesperson called it a political statement, one that's unprecedented in recent memory.
There have been times where there have been extremely tense situations between the Secretary General and various member states, but I don't recall this kind of language being used.
Despite the declaration, the UN says it'll maintain contact with Israel at operational levels.
Those reports are from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who has ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please join them. And if you are listening on a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Claudia Sheinbaum was sworn in as the first female president in the history of Mexico. United Nations satellite research discovered that two-thirds of the buildings and agricultural fields in the Gaza Strip have been destroyed or significantly damaged by Israel. Another report on Julian Assange speaking to the Human Rights Committee of the Council of Europe. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Claudia Sheinbaum was sworn in on Tuesday as the first female president in the history of Mexico during a ceremony held at the Congress of the Union. During the session in Mexico City, Claudia took the established oath and received from the hands of President of Congress the presidential sash previously delivered by the ongoing dignitary, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. On the occasion of the inauguration of the first female president of Mexico, leaders and other high officials from more than 100 countries and 22 international organizations were there, among them the dignitaries of Cuba, Miguel Díaz-Canel, of Brazil, Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, of Panama, Gustavo Petro, and Gabriel Boric of Chile. The leaders of Honduras, Xiomara Castro, and of Guatemala, Bernardo Alevo, also arrived, as well as the prime ministers of Belize, Haiti, and the Council of Presidential Transition Council of Haiti. Also present were the vice president of the Permanent Committee of the National People's Assembly of the People's Republic of China and the representatives of the director of the United Nations Population Fund. The first woman to hold the top position in Mexico obtained a landslide victory in elections of June the 2nd, in which she surpassed 35.9, almost 36 million votes, and became the most voted candidate in the recent history of Mexico. Claudia declares herself the continuator of the transformative humanist and social justice project by López Obrador, AMLO, in which, among other achievements, reduced poverty and inequality in Mexico. An analysis conducted by the United Nations Satellite Center shows that two-thirds of the total structures in the Gaza Strip have sustained damage in Israel's ongoing genocidal war on the besieged territory. Two-thirds of all total structures have been damaged. Citing high-resolution satellite imagery captured on September the 3rd and 6th, the total structure damage includes 163,000 structures, damaged almost 66% of the total destroyed. The Gaza Strip is the most impacted region overall, with 46,000 structures affected. And in another report by the Satellite Agency of the United Nations, done in collaboration with the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, found that 68% of the permanent crop fields in the Gaza Strip exhibited a significant amount in health and density in September of this year. Satellite imagery-based analysis conducted by the United Nations document the widespread destruction caused by Israeli aggression on Gaza and highlight the impacted population's need for food support. Many observers have called Israel's operation nothing less than ethnic cleansing, with the intention of total military occupation of the Gaza Strip and rebuilding Gaza to its own liking so it can be inhabited by Israeli settlers. The regime's bloody onslaught on Gaza has so far killed at least 41,600 Palestinians, mostly women and children. Thousands more are also missing and presumed dead under the rubble. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said on Tuesday that he was freed after years of incarceration because he pled guilty to journalism. Assange gave evidence of the impact of his detention and his conviction to the Legal Affairs and Human Rights Committee of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, France. The Parliamentary Assembly includes lawmakers from 46 European countries. Julian Assange was released in June after 5 years in a British prison after he pleaded guilty to obtaining and publishing U.S. military secrets in a deal with Justice Department prosecutors that concluded a drawn-out legal saga. Prior to his time in prison, in a maximum security prison in Britain for 5 years, he had spent 7 years in self-imposed exile in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he claimed asylum on the grounds of political persecution. Julian Assange says, "I am not free today because the system worked. I am free today after years of incarceration because I pled guilty to journalism." He added that he pled guilty to seeking information from a source, and he pled guilty to obtaining information from a source. "I plead guilty to informing the public what that information was." The transition from years of confinement in a maximum security prison to addressing the European parliamentarians has been, in his words, a profound and surreal shift. Assange said as he detailed the experience of years of isolation in a small cell. Julian Assange says it strips away one's sense of self, leaving only the raw essence of existence. His voice was cracking while he offered an apology for his faltering words and an unpolished presentation. "I'm not yet fully equipped to speak about what I have endured, the relentless struggle to stay alive, both physically and mentally." Julian Assange, the internet publisher, was accused of receiving and publishing hundreds of thousands of war logs and diplomatic cables that revealed the criminal war crimes of Washington in both Iraq and Afghanistan. His activities were celebrated by press freedom advocates who herald his role in bringing to light military conduct that could have been otherwise concealed. Among the files published by WikiLeaks was a video of a 2007 Apache helicopter attack by U.S. forces in Baghdad that killed 11 people, including 2 journalists from Reuters News Service.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at the website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, so I'm staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.